some of the Higgs physics and how that ties in with the derivations from supersymmetry and the experimental situation there. Then I'll turn finally to superpartners. And first I'll begin to show you how the superpartners appear in virtual ways. I talked about one piece of that with the flavor changing interaction at the beginning. And then finally we'll turn to the collider physics and begin, and I'll emphasize more next time the connection of collider physics and string theory. It's really not at all obvious how you can produce heavy particles at a collider and imagine learning something about the underlying theory and whether it's string theory and so forth. So one point that I should elucidate a little bit more is here from some questions. So we can define a minimal supersymmetric standard model, and that's the one we defined last time and counted the parameters for, and including, say, the neutrino sector, which we didn't emphasize here for time purposes. That will be true then of any theory. If you reduce a string theory and it's supersymmetric, has n equal 1 supersymmetry at the low scale, it'll contain this, but it'll very likely be an extended theory in one form or another. It could be left-right symmetric. It could be have U1 symmetries. Essentially, every string theory has U1 symmetries when you break the bigger symmetries. And so it's very likely that there will be extra stuff. But all of the stuff that we've been talking about will always be there, so that anyone who's going to try and relate the phenomena that are measured to the string theory will need to know the stuff we're explicitly talking about. I also should clarify a little better the question of the upper limit on the Higgs boson. When you do experiments at LEP, you're measuring the mass of the Z and the decays of the Z, and you're producing Ws, and at Fermilab you're producing TOPS. These are examples of diagrams where Higgses enter into loops that affect these. And in these particular diagrams, the factors that code vertices are of order 1. There's no suppression. This has an MZ at the vertex. This has an MW. This has an M top at the vertices. And so these are large contributions in general. That is, as large as loops can be. And so the physics, if you do measurements at the level of a fraction of a percent, the physics is really sensitive to those. And it's the combination of all of these. Of course, these are just pictures. You really do a full gauge invariant calculation. You can also see that they're sensitive to the logarithms of the Higgs mass rather than a power, because the couplings have mass dimensions at the vertices. And once you have mass dimensions at the vertices, then you end up with a dimensionless integral so that it will necessarily be a logarithm. It takes just a few steps. That's an ordinary field theory calculation. It takes a few steps to go through that. So for LEP, only one parameter, the mass of the Higgs boson, was unknown if you assumed that the world was a standard model world. And it was sensitive if you had sufficiently accurate data. And that gave you this graph where you simply calculate for each measurement how much it contributes to some chi-squared. And you end up then getting a curve like this. The details in the curve don't really matter. They get pinned down better with time, and the details of the result don't matter because it's a logarithm. When you look at the sensitivity, it's not too sensitive over here, and so you get some upper limit. This is growing pretty rapidly, and at some point you may get an unacceptably bad description of the data. And at that point, you say there's an upper limit on the Higgs mass, and it's not a very big number. It's somewhere in this kind of range. So we can be confident that something will turn up. And I also showed you that there's an independent piece of information the same way, because since the top and the W masses also depend on the Higgs, then you get again, and these lines are lines of constant Higgs mass, you get again an argument that depending on which data you use, you get some upper limit, but the Higgs mass shouldn't be much bigger than about 200 GeV. So something should really be found, and it hasn't been. Now, the situation is complicated, and I'm telling you partly about the complications because it's theoretically interesting to see what's happening. The direct data from LEP actually showed three, approximately two standard deviation signals. So some of them could turn up at the Tevatron if it had its full luminosity over the next couple of years. But these aren't strong enough to report a signal, so LEP just set an upper limit finally. When we go to LHC, I'll show you a little bit about it, but the bottom line is that at LHC, it's a difficult experiment, a difficult thing to do to find Higgses, and so it's going to take longer than finding superpartners. Now, let me just give you two rather detailed transparencies on the Higgs sector and how LEP might have missed finding a signal even though it were there. Basically, what happens is that one way or another, the cross-section times the branching ratio at the LEP collider are reduced. For example, I showed you the Feynman rule that put a factor of sine squared alpha minus beta, where those are the two rotation angles in the Higgs sector, in front of the cross-section, and I showed you the factors that give you the decay coupling widths that depend on the angles alpha and beta. If those are reduced so that LEP isn't sensitive, then they won't see an effect. And we actually found a large number of ways that might happen. So to present them, it's not clear how to present some complicated analysis like this. What we did is take the three ways in which LEP might have found a Higgs signal. One, that there was a signal at 115 GeV. A second one, a possible signal at 98 GeV. And a third, a signal in the combination of two channels at 187 GeV. And we use that just as an organizing principle. So I'll show you a complicated table, and I'll just illustrate a few points of it. So we're not going to learn everything in the table, but these are a number of different kinds of models, and they're physically independent in the following sense. Here's the signals that would come from them. So one of these models actually gave two standard deviation signals for all three of the LEP ones. Five of them gave two standard deviation signals for two of the three LEP ones in different combinations. Then this batch gave the 115 signal, this batch gave the 98 signal, this one gave only that. And then some just have heavier Higgses, so they wouldn't have seen anything, and there wasn't anything. Physically, I'll show you two of them in a little detail. Physically, the ones in this column, for example, have significant complex phases that go with the superpartner masses that was neglected in the LEP analysis. So six of the models come from that sort of result. And another one has a decay mode they didn't take account of. I'll just illustrate those two to show you the kind of thing that can happen. And this kind of physics can feed back into your understanding of the soft-breaking Lagrangian, and then your understanding of the theory that gives it. So here's one entry in the table where you get all three signals. It has a phase which isn't 0 or pi or 2 pi, so it's a non-trivial phase effect. The mass eigenstates, the lightest Higgs is 89 GeV. There's one at this mass and one at this mass of the three neutral ones. The branching ratios are simply reduced for the production and for the decays. And the two standard deviation signal at 187 actually comes from a combination of producing two channels that in a detector can't be separated cleanly. So it's an example which was simply not perfectly reasonable, could come out of any good string theory, but wasn't considered by Leff in studying the data. Here's a different kind of example. This is one where the lightest superpartner mass is 43.5 GeV, and that is a candidate for the dark matter. In fact, is consistent with being the dark matter of the universe in that theory. And the branching ratio for a Higgs to decay to that, where the Higgs, the lightest Higgs mass is 111 GeV, that Higgs decays to that 62% of the time. And Leff simply didn't look for that in the study, and they would have missed this entirely, even though it's a very good kind of way the Higgs sector could take form. The details don't matter, but those are examples of things that could still occur and haven't been looked at. At the Tevatron, they could, any day, start seeing a Higgs signal. If the Higgs mass, we saw that in the MSSM, the Higgs mass can go up to about 130, but in a general supersymmetric theory, it can go up to around 200. If it's in the region below about 130, and the fact that it's 130 is a kinematical accident, it's not precisely tied to the MSSM. This is the process by which you will see it at the Tevatron. That is, up and down quarks in the proton will collide and make a W, or possibly a Z, but the W is a little bigger rate. And then there's, you know, there's a W Higgs line. and the W will be taken to decay, at least for simple analyses, to a lepton like a mu or an E that you'll definitely see, and the Higgs will decay to its main B branching ratio, or possibly to the tau branching ratio. So the cross-section for this is something you can completely calculate for any particular set of parameters of the MSSM. It's of order half a picobarn. The number of events is the cross-section times the luminosity times the time. And the units this is usually given in then are inverse femtobarns. So if you have a cross-section in femtobarns, so this is 500 femtobarns cross-section. And if you take 10 inverse femtobarns, you would have 5,000 Higgses. The two detectors together so far have just under 2 inverse femtobarns now. So they're a factor of 5 to 8 below what they should have had about now. And so you can put in the branching ratios and look. If the Higgs mass is turning up at one of the places where the Leff signals were, then you won't get statistically significant results for a while, but psychologically we'll be totally happy that they're discovering the Higgs we want. So there could be something starting to turn up in the next winter from Fermilab data. And so it's worth watching and being aware that it really can be there. The experimenters may tell you that to prove statistically that they see a signal you want, since you're looking at a histogram with bins and the fluctuations can occur in any bin that fake a signal, then you want 4 or so standard deviations, maybe 5, before you trust a signal. But if it's a signal that's occurring at a pre-assigned number, like what Leff might have seen, then you're very happy and you can start, you'll start reading about it in the newspaper and celebrating. If it's heavier, you can still study it at the Tevatron. Then the dominant diagram is this one, where gluons in the protons go through a top loop and produce a Higgs. Normally, you couldn't see that because you have no way to trigger on it if it decays to BB bar. But once it's heavier than somewhere in this region, we saw yesterday that it starts to have a dominant decay to W pairs, then you can let one of the W's decay to a lepton and trigger on that and, say, pick out this sample of events. There's still background, but you can show that the distributions are different and the rates are different, and so you can analyze this. Since it's heavier, it takes more time to produce enough, but still before LHC runs, you could see a Higgs in this kind of region up to somewhere like 180 at the Tevatron if it actually works better and if the detectors work and if there are any experimenters left at the Tevatron who aren't working at LHC or on cosmology. It's not clear. At LHC, I won't go through the details because I don't think you really want to know them, but at LHC, which has got 7 times the energy of the Tevatron and hugely more intensity, the region around this low mass is difficult. So there are 4 different kinds of processes. This is the one that was at the Tevatron for lower mass, this at the Tevatron for higher mass. Then at LHC, you produce over 10 to the fifth top quarks, and so you can radiate a few hundred Higgses off the top quarks. And events like this are pretty good signatures because this and this both give a B quark, and so do these, and so you have very B-rich events. And you can tell that you had top-like things, and so this is another way to get a signal. And then a quite different way is that the colliding protons effectively make beams of Ws, and all the rest of the stuff just goes off more or less down the beam pipe or recoils a little bit. And that's, again, a standard WW Higgs vertex. You can produce a Higgs and look. And that'll be totally a low-mass central region. That is, you'll have a collision, but instead of putting hundreds and hundreds of GeV of energy in, you'll just produce one Higgs boson, which is not very heavy, and see central stuff like this. And you tag the event by saying that there was something that occurred because this stuff comes out, even though it's not really identifiable. It does tell you there was an event. What is most likely to happen from simulations is that all 4 of those will occur. None of them will give a definitive signal, so lots of people will say nothing's been discovered. But, and you shouldn't, in some sense, combine data from completely different things. But in fact, we know enough to combine the data. And if you have 3 or 4 two standard deviation signals, again, you've really got a meaningful discovery if they're at the same mass. That's the crucial point, is that if they're all giving you the same mass, you're okay. Now let's go back to the point that I mentioned a couple of times about the fine-tuning, and I'm going to show you a little more about where that comes from and the odd way in which it's being realized, because it could be a really big clue to the kind of extended MSSM that we have and the underlying theory. So if you take those 2 conditions for radiative electroweak symmetry breaking that we wrote and combine them, solve for the Z mass, then this equation is equivalent to what I said then was the most important equation in supersymmetry physics, because it relates a real number to the supersymmetry breaking. And in addition, you simplify the equation, or you put the equation in a form. A bar over something means it's a high-scale number. So before, I gave you a low-scale set of relations so that the Higgs potential would have a good minimum away from the origin. Now you just take the renormalization group equations that we wrote, or that I showed you, and you invert those to express it in terms of the high-scale mu and the high-scale M3, the SU3 mass, and M2, and M1, and so forth. You can include everything, and most of them aren't very important for the argument, so I've left them off. So this form is instructive, because what you see is that, for example, in TeV units, the left-hand side would be 0.01. The high-scale mu didn't run very much, if you remember the graphs I showed you, and so the high-scale mu it is typically pretty big, but it has a lower limit of the order of 100 GeV, so then you're within a factor of 2 of this sort of number, or a little less. But M3, if it's a normal mass, should be a few hundred GeV, and that gets squared, and then it has a big coefficient because of color effects. And so basically, if you'd sort of guessed from this side what the Z mass should be, you would have picked a number in the order of half a TeV or bigger, but it's not. And we don't know how serious that is till we measure these. This kind of relation was first written down nearly 2 decades ago, and it's been studied a lot. The first form it was written was one where you assume that the 3 gauge genome masses, M1, M2, and M3, are degenerate at the high scale, as they might be in some grand unified theories and in some simpler ad hoc kinds of approaches. In that case, if you have these three numbers and you make you add them up, notice that these don't have to be so big, but they would be, or so small, I mean, but they would be if this one had to be small because you combined them. Then you predict that you should have already seen charginos and neutralinos at LEF, and you're really in a complete disaster if you insist that the three of them are degenerate, because you should have seen 50 GeV superpartners at LEF, and you don't see them. It gets much worse. But if you write the correct relation and give up the Gagino mass degeneracy, so that's a clue already to the form of the string theory, because any string theory which led you to Gagino mass degeneracy would have a contradiction with this fine-tuning, because you didn't see these things at LEF. And it's a clue to the kind of form that the theory can take. We studied whether cancellations can occur in this, whether we can change the running scales, change the running rates with intermediate scale matter. It turns out that when you look at the full problem, nothing you do helps. You always end up with at least as much fine-tuning. So this is a very robust problem. And I only know of two kinds of solutions, well, three kinds in a sense. Maybe some fine-tuning is there accidentally. I gave you two examples of that last time, and I'll give you one more in a minute, where there seems to be real fine-tuning occurring unless you understand the theory. But it could be that the Higgs is light, as I just described in the first few minutes today, but rather non-standard model-like and hasn't been seen yet. Or the low-scale theory could really be an extended kind of theory of some sort and will be different from the MSSM, but include it. The most common kind is where people write theories with an extra U1 and a scalar chiral superfield, a scalar particle will be included in a chiral superfield. That's very nice in the sense that the extra U1 symmetry, while it's unbroken, can prevent a mu term from occurring in the superpotential. Once the symmetry gets broken, then the vacuum expectation value of the scalar can become the mu term. And so if it's broken in such a way that it only occurs at the electroweak scale, then you indeed get an explanation for the mu problem, and it fits in beautifully, and it basically solves these fine-tuning problems. So it's a very nice form, and people have increasingly worked on writing nice theories that do that, but the U1 structure of the string scale theories is very poorly understood, and the charges of the particles are not well known. There's only, I think, the only theory in which the charges of all of states under the U1 symmetries are computed is a heterotic string theory compactified on a Z3 orbifold. But I think there's no other case known where you can actually work out such a theory completely. But that may be telling us that kind of thing. Now, the fine-tuning is much worse if you look carefully when you combine the Z and the Higgs data, and this graph will illustrate that for you. So what's shown here is M3 and here a trilinear parameter, the details don't matter. This is a line of constant M Higgs equal 112 GeV. This is a line of constant M Higgs equal 115. And the epsilons are more or less the amount of fine-tuning of the Z-max. So this graph shows you that if you just go up 3 GeV in Higgs mass from 112 to 115, that the effect, for example, on M3, to which the fine-tuning was sensitive, is a huge jump. If it started out down here where you'd sort of like it, then it can have a factor of 5 or more jump in M3. And even in the higher regions, a factor of 2 or more, for just a 3% change in the Higgs mass. It's an extremely sensitive situation, and the fine-tuning of the Z calculated in, it doesn't really matter how you calculate, you get similar numbers, jumps by 50% for a 3% change in that. And these are general and representative kinds of numbers. So that is what's called the little fine-tuning problem for the Higgs sector. So just for fun, here's another cancellation that occurs. If you calculate simply the branching ratio of the second neutralino to decay to the final state with any two fermions, quark anti-quark, or lepton anti-lepton, and an LSP, then you have two diagrams, one where the decay is through a Z, and one where it's, that's that one, through the Z, and one where it's through the slepton or squark. And they necessarily have the opposite sign from the Lagrangian of the theory. You can calculate that. And you can then see that depending on the slepton mass along here, you can have a huge variation. The solid line is the total. If you had, depending on where you look, you can get an order of magnitude or more cancellation between these. And that's a real effect that you're told by the theory will really occur. Once you measure that, it lets you get a handle on the slepton mass, for example. Okay, just a few more interesting things about the Higgs sector and the real world. At tree level, we saw that the Higgs sector conserves CP, so you could give the different particles a definite CP eigenvalue. But we also saw that, especially if, in general, this that loop diagram, the correction to the lambda phi fourth term will be large because the Yukawa couplings of top and stop are large. And particularly if the Higgs mass has to be raised from above MZ up to 115 or more GeV, this diagram must contribute a large number. So if you look at the mass matrix of the stops, simply take the soft-breaking Lagrangian we wrote, pick out the left and right-handed stops, but you can't know that it's Flavr diagonal. So in fact, each of these has to be a three column thing in Flavr space, because stop can include Charman up. And so define a mass matrix M stop by writing that part of the Lagrangian like this. Then that matrix looks like this, where this is the 3x3 Flavr matrix of the soft term, and this is the 3x3 Flavr matrix of the trilinear term and the other soft term. You also get some D terms of the sort that we wrote down, which are less important. And these terms are coming from F terms, which are written out here a little bit. So if you just calculate the F terms by writing it, you get cross products when you take the derivatives. So this is a complex matrix then, which goes into that stuff. And then when you do that, you have to re-minimize the Higgs potential. You have to go back to the beginning and start your calculation again and allow a relative phase between the up and down type Higgs parts, both complex doublets, but now a possible relative phase theta, because you're adding complex things. The phases coming in are not new ones. They're the same complex phases we had in the soft Lagrangian. So we understand where they come from. There's nothing new or mysterious. If theta is to go away, you will find that out by going to the minimum of the Higgs potential and calculating. And it turns out that it does not go away in general. So if you count parameters, you can actually see then that the masses of the Higgs sectors and the production cross-sections and all the decay branching ratios actually depend on the parameters that come in through that loop as well. So they depend on the phases of the mu parameter and the trilinear parameters, and they depend on the soft breaking masses and the soft B term. And you have to measure at least 7 observables in the Higgs sector if you're going to be able to invert it and figure out what the soft Lagrangian parameters are. You can do it in models, and you find that the angles can be very significant. It gets amusing experimentally, because then the A and the H states will mix, and so you could actually, in one experiment, produce all three Higgses in the spectrum and have CP violating effects. And numerically, I won't go into details, but you can see that the effects can be quite large. Now, newspapers and articles in magazines and politicians and lab directors and people like that constantly are saying that Higgs physics explains the origin of mass. That's not very true, and one should probably understand that, although we don't want to tell the politicians, I guess, but it's still worth knowing. Higgs physics does allow mass to be accommodated in the theory, and it's a necessary condition for quarks and leptons to have mass. But imagine that you're in a string world. Then in a string world, you have a superpotential with Yukawa couplings at the high scale before supersymmetry and the standard model symmetries are broken. There is no mass. The particles don't have mass at all, at least up to gravitational curvature. But they have Yukawa couplings. Once you go through the electroweak phase transition, then the Higgs field gets VEVs. Then you can define a mass, which is a product of a Yukawa coupling times the Higgs VEV. So the VEV allows mass to occur for quarks and leptons and Ws and Zs. But the amount of mass is determined by the string theory through the superpotential. And through the supersymmetric part of the superpotential does not depend on supersymmetry breaking there. The supersymmetry breaking enters because you can't get a Higgs VEV without supersymmetry breaking. So that's the separation that matters. Furthermore, the mass of everything we see is coming from protons and neutrons. And we know that the mass of a proton or a neutron from QCD would change only a few percent at most if you let the quark masses be zero. That is, the mass of a proton or a neutron is coming mainly from the motion of quarks and gluons in the proton or neutron. And so the mass of us or a star would change almost not at all if you didn't have a Higgs mechanism occur, if you didn't have Higgs particles at all. The main source of mass of superpartners is supersymmetry breaking, not electroweak breaking. There is some contribution to the mass, but the main mass in the universe is the dark matter, and if that is the lightest superpartner or not superpartners at all, then that has nothing to do with the Higgs mechanism either. So the Higgs mechanism is responsible for a few particles getting mass, but has very little to do with the full origin of mass. Nevertheless, if we don't understand how the electroweak symmetry is broken, we will have probably a very hard time going ever beyond the standard model. There is a sense in which we've already seen Higgs bosons, because remember in the Higgs mechanism, the W and Z bosons eat the Goldstone boson that's coming from the Higgs sector that was massless because you broke a global symmetry. And so the third spin state, the longitudinal spin state of the W and the Z, is a Higgs state, necessarily. Unfortunately, we can't study it that way. The Lorentz invariance of the theory means that you can rotate the three polarization states of a W1 into the other completely, and you can't learn anything about the underlying dynamics because the Lorentz invariance guarantees the rotation. If you produce W's and Z's in pairs, then chiral symmetries of the theory actually determine the scattering of the W's and Z's at threshold and the first derivative at threshold. Again, symmetry of the physics of the Lagrangian mean that you can't learn anything. You might think it's nice that the value and the first derivative are determined independent of your knowledge about the mechanisms of the breaking of the electroweak symmetry. But it's really the opposite. We would like to learn something about the breaking, and we're prevented. So it turns out you have to be able to measure the second derivative, which means going up to W pair energies of the order of a TeV, and that is barely possible at LHC. Very difficult and unlikely to be studyable under those conditions. So the world is conspiring to make the Higgs sector very difficult for us. All right, that, I hope, was not too much Higgs physics, but I think the importance of it is sometimes not emphasized, but really there. Now I'm going to turn to superpartners, and first we'll go through describing the superpartners themselves in more detail, and then we'll turn to the experimental ways they show up. So I'll just go ahead and draw Feynman diagrams, but remember first that there's a complete set of Feynman rules in that review article in an appendix, if you want to get them. And in general, except for cases where Higgs-Vevs are present and are confusing a little bit, you can always write down any diagram by just taking a standard model of vertices and replacing the partners, the standard model particles by their superpartners in pairs. So that's how you can get all the diagrams I draw. So let's go through and talk about the different cases a bit now, and in particular diagonalize those mass matrices so that the particles that show up in the New York Times will be the ones that we look at rather than the symmetry eigenstates. Gluinos will be produced most if their mass is acceptable or not too large. And since they're partners of gluons that have two polarization states, they will have 2 degrees of freedom and be Majorana particles. They're fermions that are color octets. There aren't any other states in a minimal theory for them to mix with, though it's conceivable that in extended theory there could be. So you sort of directly measure that parameter. On the other hand, not really, because there are radiative corrections that could be very important. Here is a typical expression for the radiative corrections to the gluino, and they can be 30 or 40% in some cases. So you might have a qualitative measurement, but until you know something about the squark masses and such things, you won't know what the full theory, what the full real mass of the gluino is, and be able to invert it to get the soft mass M3. Just to get a feeling for the numbers, if you do set the 3-gauge gluino masses equal at a high scale around the grand unification, the unification of coupling scale, and then you run down, the masses run like the gauge couplings at one loop. And so you find that the three masses at low scale are in a ratio of 7:2:1, which is a mnemonic to keep in mind to compare with that kind of theory. And then the gluino mass will be about 2.9 times the soft mass when you put all the numbers together. There's interesting tests you could do in principle, but no one has got a way yet to do this test in practice. But let me illustrate the kinds of things you know about the theory. The gluino-gluino-gluon coupling in the Lagrangian has the antisymmetric tensor Fijk coming in from writing the full set of structure constants. And if you put that in the conventional form, then the term with a gamma 5 drops out because of the symmetries. And it's a Majorana particle, and that guarantees that the symmetry alone is enough to do it. So gluinos are supposed to have only a vector coupling to gluons, no axial vector coupling. That's a clean prediction. That's a real test of the supersymmetry of the theory, and an interesting one, but not easy to check. Here's how you measure the gluino phase. Again, I'll just illustrate it without going through all the details. So in the Lagrangian, you have a gluino mass term, and the mass M3 is complex in general. The simplest way to deal with these kinds of calculations, just a practical issue, is to get rid of the phase in the mass so it's not in the propagators, and rotate it into vertices, which are easier to deal with. So the vertices will then get factors like this. If you look at the production of the gluino, here's a diagram starting from quarks and protons where you can produce gluinos, then the phase comes in and it's complex conjugate, so it cancels there, and the production is indeed independent. But the gluino does decay, and it'll decay to some other state. So here's just a toy example where it decays to a beano, which has the phase of the U1 part of the theory, phi1. And then the relative phase of phi3 and phi1 comes in. And so you can actually then write this down, let the gluinos decay, write down the matrix element, square it, sum over unobserved spins and things. and you get a cross-section as a function of a kinematical variable. The details don't matter. You can see the form of it if you want. But the key thing is that there's a large term, potentially large term, depending on the cosine or the relative phase of those two masses. And this is one of those reparameterization invariant phases. You can never rotate that phase away. It's a physical phase as fundamental as the top mass or the CKM phase or anything, and needs to be measured and tells you about the underlying theory. I will, in a few minutes, I'll go through a detailed exercise in a rotating phases away to show you that a little more clearly. But if it shows up in an observable quantity, you know it's a reparameterization invariant thing. The phases that come in here are the same phases that come in K-on physics and B-physics, for example, because in those you have superpartner diagrams involving these same kinds of particles. And so those phases are in principle comparable and measurable in different places. Once the electroweak symmetry is broken, then the four superpartners of W's and B's, B being the U1 gauge boson and the two Higgs neutral states, will have be spin and half particles which are not prevented from mixing, so in ordinary quantum theory they will mix and give you mass eigenstates. Same thing will happen in the charge sector. We'll keep careful track of the lightest of the neutralinos because it's a good candidate for the dark matter, and I'll go through that a little bit in a few minutes. So then you get a normal quantum mechanical mass matrix, unfortunately, which obscures some of the physics because you'll produce in experiments the mass eigenstates. If you take the soft breaking Lagrangian and choose a basis Beano, Weino, and the down and up type Higgsinos, and then write the Lagrangian in this form just to get a mass matrix out, then this is the mass matrix you get. It's got complex elements in general because those phases are present. You can diagonalize it by a single unitary transformation. Then, you having diagonalized it, you re-express the states from the soft Lagrangian in terms of these guys, but that matrix comes in, so they enter every Feynman rule for these states then. So in this basis, the matrix looks like this. It's symmetric. You have the U1 and SU2 Gugino masses, each with their own phase. And then the off-diagonal elements are real predictions of supersymmetry again. They have to do with relating. The off-diagonal elements really connect the standard model and supersymmetry, and so measuring them would be particularly important. And you can see exactly what they are from the calculations with the soft Lagrangian. There are, of course, many bases you can put them in, and it could be a possible amusing basis is if you let the photon and Z be diagonal and you take symmetric and anti-symmetric parts in the Higgs sector. Then if your theory has M1 and M2 approximately equal, then this term would drop out. And if tangent beta is indeed above 3 or 4, then sine 2 beta gets very small. So these two terms would drop out. So you actually have a rather simple matrix. And it's a little easier to do calculations and to see what's happening. Several times I'll use this expression. The lightest neutralino will necessarily be some linear combination of Beano-like and Weino-like and two Higgsino-like things with just arbitrary coefficients. These are just normal quantum theory wave functions. There's nothing even special from the supersymmetry point of view about this. The sum of squares of the coefficients is 1, so this is normalized if the separate ones are normalized. And the behavior of dark matter and of these guys in detectors and so forth are determined by these things, and they can be very, very different. And let me come back to it in context, but we'll have to keep remembering that expression. So for pedagogical reasons, let me show you one Feynman rule. Again, once you've written down one, then writing down the rest is easy, and they all do occur in the review article. So here's one neutralino coupling to a selectron and an electron. So the Feynman rule then, writing the neutralino as a combination of those four things, the Feynman rule for the benol part coupling is proportional to the hypercharge. So the hypercharge of the left-handed and right-handed electrons are here. And so it's alpha times that piece with that hypercharge. Then the coupling to the W to the weno part is the same as the coupling to the W with the projection operator, 1 minus gamma 5, and the G2 gauge coupling. Then the coupling to this down-type Higgs is present because down-type Higgs actually give mass to electrons. And so that coupling is proportional to the Yukawa coupling of the electron, where the mass of the electron, that is numerically a very small term. And then the electron doesn't have any coupling to the up-type Higgs, so there's a zero there. So you can just go through and write down the full Feynman rules of the entire theory step by step and understand where all of them come from. You do a similar thing for chargenos. Again, you take the soft Lagrangian and write the part that depends on Higgsinos and chargenos in this form. And now you have to be rather careful. It's like combining positrons and electrons into a four-component Dirac spinner when they have mass. So you get Wienos and Higgsinos and the two charge states, just like particle and antiparticle. And if you choose that basis, then the mass matrix that's in the middle can be written in this form. You have to go in two steps. So this is a 2x2 matrix, and this is a 2x2 one. And this 2x2 one actually has the information in it. And I haven't written the phases here. I'll come back in a minute and write the phases. These are complex, in other words. M2 and mu are complex. And I'll write the phases explicitly in a minute. Now, to diagonalize this, because it's not symmetric, to get the two mass eigenstates, you have to do one rotation on these guys and possibly a separate rotation on these guys. So the diagonal matrix can have two matrices. And again, if you go look at the Feynman rules, you will see those two matrices present. All of them, of course, are calculable from any string theory that you actually understand. Now comes some really important things for making the fundamental connections to experiment. So let's take that chargenal mass matrix. Here it is. It's got the soft terms M2 and the term mu, which is like a soft term, but remember mu has a separate origin in general. It's got the angle beta of tangent beta, and it's got these phases. The simplest way to look at it is take the trace of a matrix, which is the sum of the eigenvalues, and square it first to make it symmetric, and then you don't have to go through the separate diagonalization. So square it, take the trace. The sum of these is the eigenvalues, and that sum of squares is then these two soft terms and the known MW. But the product, the determinant of that 2x2 matrix is the product of the eigenvalues. And so this is a really important equation. It depends on M2 and mu. It depends on tangent beta. And it depends on, again, a combination of phases, which is a reparameterization invariant physical combination of phases. So there are four fundamental Lagrangian parameters in this. one important point to understand that people sometimes don't think about, somehow people associate phases with CP violation, and that's true. To get CP violation, you must have the complex phases. But it doesn't go the other way. These phases are coming into a cosine. They don't cause any CP violation here. These are just masses. If you play with numbers, you can see that the masses of these guys can change by factors of several, depending on what these phases are. So the phases of the soft terms can completely change the masses of the physical mass eigenstate particles produced at colliders. If you neglect the phases, as has been done in all of the phenomenology done by either ATLAS or CMS detectors at LHC or the two detectors at Fermilab. Not a single analysis they've done to study what the detector can do or to analyze data has ever included the effects of phases. So any conclusion they draw is necessarily not robust under the simple MSSM theory. These are really possibly very important and have to be included to do the stuff right. Also, suppose you measure the two Chargino mass eigenstates, you can't invert two numbers to get the four soft Lagrangian parameters. So in the Chargino sector alone, even if you could measure the two Chargino states, and I'll argue later next time that you can't, you can't invert to get the soft Lagrangian parameters at a hadron collider. And that's what you need to connect with a real theory. You need the soft Lagrangian. You need to understand it. So this little example is very helpful in understanding the issues that will come up. If we could have a lepton collider, an electron linear collider, for example, that would give us more equations, and we could measure more unknowns, and the same quantities appear, and then we could invert it. But in practice, it's essentially inconceivable to have an electron linear collider in less than 10 years. And that's a very conservative number. Probably 15 is a more realistic number after you start trying to fund it, which hasn't started yet. So we're only going to have LHC for the relevant time of interest. We could push that argument. So we have these four parameters and we want to measure more. We could say, well, okay, the two Chargino masses aren't enough, but let's add cross sections for producing them. That gives you more numbers. But if you write down cross sections here, this is written for electrons, here for quarks, here you exchange quarks, so you start adding more parameters, the quark masses and the couplings that come here. And at a hadron collider, you can simply count the number of independent practical observables and the number of parameters, and there's always more parameters than observables. You can never really invert. An exercise that has not been gone through is that you can add the neutralino sector, which overlaps some parameters with this one, and the Higgs sector, which does. And it's conceivable that if you add them all up, that in some cases at least, you can do that inversion. It doesn't particularly look like it, but no one has gone through the counting in a careful way in a case like that for realistic models. So is it possible to rotate the phases away? Here's the kind of thing you would do. You would replace the WINO with a rotated phase alpha 1, and the Higgs-Zeno upstate, say, with a rotated phase alpha 3, and the downstate with alpha 2. There'll be an overall phase, so you can only replace those three. Then you take your original matrix and redefine it this way, and so you would get a matrix like this. And in order to change the phase structure, you would have to satisfy these three equations then, and you can quickly see that by just adding and subtracting in your head that you have zeros in these and not zero here. And so there's no solution to those equations, and that's the kind of way you can prove in a simple, practical way that the phases that you've got are totally invariant. Reparameterization and variant ones. How heavy should the superpartners be, and why haven't we seen them yet, and why, how might we see them? Well, there are various clues that you might think would tell you something about the superpartners. If the LSP were cold dark matter, then the LSPs have to annihilate. You actually produce too many LSPs in the early universe. They must annihilate fairly efficiently to get down to a number that doesn't overclose the universe. And a sufficient condition for that would that the sleptons were fairly light and coupled to them, because then you could have diagrams where LSPs went through virtual T-channels, leptons, and annihilated into standard model particles. but first, we don't know that the LSP is the cold dark matter. That's not yet established. And second, it could be special, such that there can be a Higgs resonance, so that the two LSPs can couple strongly to a Higgs resonance state. And then you get, if you have a resonance state in the S channel, you can get a factor of 100 enhancement at the resonance. And if the masses were just right, you could annihilate through them. And so you can't use an argument like this to say that, say, sleptons have to be light enough to make this work. There's simply, not only don't we know whether LSPs are the cold dark matter, but any particular choice of masses I can get out of by some trick like this. Another argument that people have tried to give is to say that the baryon asymmetry of the universe comes from an asymmetry generated at the electroweak phase transition. As the universe cools through the electroweak phase, you generate the actual matter asymmetry, so at a temperature of about 100 GeV or so. The problem is that, first, again, you don't know if that's how the matter asymmetry is generated. You know there is an electroweak phase transition, but the matter asymmetry could be generated by other mechanisms like the leptogenesis one, or Affleck-Dine one, or something else. So, at least until there's very strong positive evidence for this, you can't really use that argument to get light superparticles. If you knew this did occur, then you would know that both Stotz and Chargino's had to have masses less than about a top mass. Otherwise, quantitatively, you can't have this. But people who like leptogenesis say that that simply demonstrates this doesn't occur. And these guys don't have to be light. I've shown you the sensitivity of M. Higgs to having some light superpartners, and that's probably the strongest argument, that is most sensitive to the gluon. So if supersymmetry is relevant to the real world, then I'd bet that gluinos are less than 500 GeV and will be produced prolifically at LHC. That's the strongest argument, but it's not a proof. Gauge coupling unification is a very strong argument, but it's also not a proof because you can't make it quantitative enough, it turns out, and you don't know about extra intermediate scale matter. The radiative electroweak symmetry breaking is tied to the Higgs mass, and it gives you that only relation and the fine-tuning one, so it's really the combination of these that makes me think that gluinos should be light. But gluinos are the only superpartners that need to be light under those conditions. So now let's turn systematically to how evidence for superpartners could actually show up in experiments. Unfortunately, it will not happen the way it's always happened before in particle physics, that there will be a clear, unambiguous supersymmetric effect. That's because of the need to pair produce the superpartners. Each one has a lightest superpartner that will escape the detector. The lightest superpartners will escape because they're linear combinations of electrically neutral things that that have only weak interactions then, Higgsinos and Wienos and Binos and so forth. No strong, no electromagnetic interactions. If you have only weak interactions, that's interacting just like a neutrino. And you know neutrinos can go through the Earth or the Sun without interacting. So can these guys. So the LSPs will simply escape detectors. And if there's two per event, then you can never match up. You don't know where they went, so you can never match them up with particles and plot a mass peak of any kind. It's impossible. There are small parts of the parameter space where some events give rise to energetic photons. And we'll briefly look at one of those. But so if you're lucky, there might be some stronger clues like that that are helpful. But it's a small enough part of the parameter space in general that it would take some work to show it, but it would at least, you still wouldn't get a mass peak, but you would get these photons that never occur any other way. So the problem is that there's not going to be a simple way to have things stand out. I will first look at virtual particle ways that that supersymmetry might show up, and then I'll turn to the collider physics mostly next time. So I mentioned in the introductory part that electric dipole moments work. Here's why electric dipole moments are a very good probe. In the standard model, an electric dipole moment, well, in general, an electric dipole moment's an imaginary part of some amplitude. In the standard model, you have to have all three families somehow occurring in this diagram to get a complex amplitude. Otherwise, you can rotate the phases away. You know that in the standard model, if you only have two families or one, that the CKM phase can be made, taken away, rotated away in general. So if all three don't occur, you can't get an imaginary part. That means that you have to have at least two loops. The Foucault can attach anywhere in the diagram, but you must have at least two loops with their suppressions. In addition, an electric dipole moment, by definition of its Lorentz invariance properties, has to have a flip from a left to a right-handed electron or muon or quark. And W bosons don't couple to right-handed stuff. So if you draw diagrams where W comes out here, that's 0-2. By the time you write down a diagram which is non-zero, it's a three-loop diagram, and it actually, the simplest one actually has some cancellations. So you get such tiny numbers for EDMs in the standard model that it's hopelessly small. That's great because it means it's a good window for new physics. We love things that are not present in the standard model, because then we can study them and hopefully see new physics. So the kind of contribution you get then from supersymmetry doesn't have to vanish. You can have superpartners in the loops, electrons or quarks, and the superpartners in the loops can have lots of complex masses come in, and they can have lots of chirality flips. And so at one loop in general, you do get an expression. If you're looking at the electron one, you don't get the colored particle here. You get charginos and neutralinos. If you're looking at the neutron one, you get all of them, but in particular, gluinos and charginos are larger. If all the phases are random and of order one and the masses are not particularly big, then you get numbers that are 10 to 50 times the existing limits already. So you would naively have expected to see something in these processes for electron and neutron electric dipole moments, and you don't see something. So that's already a wonderful constraint on the theory. If you study the theory, you should then find that only that it basically points you to the kinds of string theories that could be consistent with this sort of restriction. And once a non-zero value is found, and the experiments are a number of experiments are underway that could do that, then the situation is quite nice and you'll be able to learn a lot. The anomalous magnetic moments, and of the muon is the only one that's really sensitive, will also be very helpful. And it's a very interesting analysis from the supersymmetric point of view. The experiment sees almost a three standard deviation effect, and that's nice. It's got to come from diagrams like this, then, with charginos and neutralinos and sneutrinos and smuons in them. Suppose you take the 105-parameter MSSM Lagrangian that we wrote down. Then, if you just count the parameters that occur in the kinds of diagrams here, you get this set. So there's about 11 parameters that come in, and you'll measure one number, so you'll get a sum rule that 11 parameters combine, a function of 11 parameters combined to give you that. But if you think about it a little bit, you get some interesting simplifications. First, I mentioned earlier that, and let me repeat it here, that the electroweak contribution to this whole process is such that to get this kind of deviation, the supersymmetric contribution would have to be about 3 times the electroweak contribution. That's huge. You expect supersymmetry generally to be less than electroweak effects. How can that happen? Well, the only way that would make any sense is if the supersymmetry contribution were proportional to tangent beta, which can get to be a large parameter. And in fact, this contribution, if you calculate it, is proportional to tangent beta once tangent beta gets to be larger than a few. It has, this is one term of this diagram. Then, if you do that, the contributions from M2 and mu are combining to make the mass of the lighter chargino, which dominates this diagram. So one parameter's effect basically disappears. The parameter M1 isn't present in this diagram, so that parameter disappears. In general, the phase will affect it if you want to get the value, and this is a different phase from one we've seen before, but it's again one that's a fundamental reparameterization invariant phase. But suppose we just want to kind of get a limit on this term divided by this one, then we can set this phase factor to 1. And at that point, we're down to basically tangent beta and 1 mass, which we can study. So you can see that you can, in spite of having all the parameters of the theory, we never simplified and got rid of them. You can do real calculations and really useful studies in general. Collider physics will be the same way. Theoretically, it's also quite interesting. It was proved, one of the first things proved about supersymmetry in 1975 by Ferrara and Remiti was that in the supersymmetric limit, magnetic moments completely vanish. Not just the supersymmetric part, but the full standard model plus supersymmetric part. That's essentially the same argument as solving the hierarchy problem because of the fermionic and bosonic parts canceling. So both a good practical way to check a calculation and something that makes this a great homework problem in a graduate class, for example, is to look and see how that occurs. And in the supersymmetry limit, the two neutralinos that are lighter get 0 mass, and their contribution exactly cancels the photon contribution. The two neutralinos that are heavier become a Z mass and exactly cancel the Z contribution. And the two chargino states become a W, or the hexino drops out, the chargino becomes a W, and they cancels the W contribution exactly. In addition, the experiment must have the supersymmetry part add to the standard model part. And if you look in the supersymmetry limit, then they're actually canceling, as we saw here. But if you look at the piece that grows with tangent beta, it has the opposite sign. And so you can actually check that the sign effect works. If there is an effect, then it's got to come from that piece, and that's consistent with this. So it's a very nice theoretical laboratory to see that you understand the basic physics going on. So electron dipole moments, G minus 2, are two places you could see something. G minus 2, the experiment is done. Their Brookhaven lab is where the experiments were done recently. They have approved new experiment, but it's not funded. Department of Energy and NSF have not agreed to provide any money for it, so it's unlikely that experiment will ever be done. There's still room for the theory to improve because experimental number got interesting, then theorists recalculated everything, found 3 or 4 mistakes in the old literature, as will always happen. And now there's a theory number that's basically settled down, but parts of it can have smaller errors if the calculations are done a bit better. So that number won't get much better. In terms of a discovery, where it'll really be useful is if superpartners are definitely discovered somewhere else, then that will provide a powerful constraint on tangent beta and those phases, and that'll be very helpful. Another thing that could happen soon, like tomorrow or any day, is that Fermilab, they could report a funny discovery of a B sub S meson to a muon pair. That's another thing to which we're simply very sensitive, again, because the standard model contribution is tiny. Here's the standard model diagram. You have a loop with W's and tops going through a Higgs to make a muon pair. And the standard model prediction is a little bigger than 10 to the minus 9 branching ratio. The B sub S mesons are when you combine a B quark with an S bar, or other way around. They're not made at the B factories at all, because the B factories run where they can make B sub D mesons. But hadron colliders, Fermilab and LHC, will make lots and lots of B sub S's. And this final state is one that's particularly easy to study. You also make the decay to electron pairs and to taus, and so forth, but this is the one that experimentally is easy. So the others could be present, but that's the one you want to study. This is a huge window. The supersymmetry prediction from diagrams with superpartners in the loops instead, you can just imagine putting superpartners in the loops instead of standard model particles. Then you get various factors of tangent beta from the vertices when you do that. It's sort of complicated, so I won't go through it. Remember, in the couplings, you had things like sine and cosine of beta, so you have to combine all that stuff. But you get powers of tangent beta, like tangent cube beta, coming into the most favorable amplitude. So if tangent beta is 4 or 5, you can get a huge enhancement of this, and it could turn up any minute. The background is not 0, because detectors can fail, but 3 or 4 events of this at Fermilab would constitute a signal and a real breakthrough, and it's one of the places to watch soon. I won't go through the theory, which is kind of interesting because of time, but it's potentially quite a powerful tool. LHC should test it all the way down to the standard model. Now let's turn to dark matter finally. So let me repeat that the lightest superpartner is some linear combination of these guys. If it's going to be detected in a detector in a laboratory, then it's these guys that scatter one by one, and you can see, you can think about how they scatter in their own way. If it's going to annihilate, it's pairs of them that annihilate. So why is the lightest superpartner a good dark matter candidate? Well, if it's stable because of our parity conservation, then it'll hang around in the following sense. As the universe, at the Big Bang, you will produce not only all the normal particles, but all the superpartners. And once you've gotten cool enough so that the superpartners have mass and the other heavier particles in the standard model have mass, like tops and then W's and Z's, they will all decay into this set of particles. This is all that'll be left at that point. So these guys will form hadrons, and the hadrons will turn into nuclei, and then they'll combine with electrons to form atoms. So you'll have atoms after a while, and photons, and neutrinos, and LSPs, and that's all. We know that the calculations from the Big Bang tell us that the standard model fraction of the total energy density of the universe is about 0.04, and that makes sense. But to calculate this part, we have to think through what happens to these guys as the universe cools. So they will, in general, annihilate. Any pair of LSPs can annihilate through a Z or by exchanging something. Somewhere I drew a diagram, which I'll come to. So an annihilation cross-section, they'll be essentially at rest. The universe will be pretty cool compared to their mass, and they'll be largely at rest at that point. So a low-energy cross-section will be essentially G Fermi squared times the square of the center of mass energy times the density of these guys, and the energy will be more or less the temperature. And the expansion rate of the universe will be bringing them further apart while they're trying to annihilate, and that's governed by the Hubble parameter, which goes as the temperature squared. at a certain point when they can't find any more LSPs to annihilate, that's called freezing out. So they basically stop. That's when the annihilation cross-section and the Hubble parameter are about the same. So the density inverting that other equation is something like that number, which if you put in numbers is a value like that. Then you have to work out separately that the temperature at the freeze out is about 1 GeV, and the entropy of the universe is about 1 GeV cubed. So I'm taking those numbers from astral particle cosmology. Then the ratio of the LSP to photon number is actually about the same, 10 to the minus 9, as the ratio of the baryon to the photon number. So very crudely, so this is a qualitative argument to let you see how the numbers more or less come out okay. The fraction of the universe taken up by LSPs is more or less the fraction taken up by baryons, that was 4%, times the mass ratio. So if they're 10 times heavier than baryons, you expect the sort of number that's observed. So this crude argument is giving you, we really expect these to be 50 to 100 GeV and these to be 1. So this crude argument is giving you a number that's a little off, but qualitatively you can see where it comes from. And if you put in all the factors, you can get good numbers. To actually do the calculation, you have to write down Boltzmann's equation and start calculating from the beginning and carry through a detailed calculation as the universe evolves. And you get numbers that can be about right. But if Wino's annihilate, which they can do through example through Z's, if that's the part, if the LSP is mostly Wino, it can annihilate very efficiently. Similarly, Higgs-Zeno's can annihilate through Z's, or Wino Higgs-Zeno. But Beano's couple to almost nothing. Beano's don't couple the photons, they don't couple the Z's, they don't couple the W's. Very hard for Beano's to annihilate. So if the LSP was mainly Beano, then you would have a huge amount left over, and in the other case, very little. So it is model dependent in a serious way, and you can think of it again. The way I prefer to think of it is that once we get data, the fact that it's model dependent is great because it will tell us something really quantitative about what's happening. In addition, all serious theories tend to produce non-thermal production of LSPs. For example, if gravitinos are present and are heavier than the lightest superpartner, at various stages of the universe's evolution, you'll have large numbers of gravitinos produced. And then they will all decay into LSPs. And that can actually be the dominant production of LSPs rather than the Big Bang thermal production. And there are other scenarios like that for the theory and the evolution of the universe that can produce effects like that. So you can have very different results. A third thing that can happen that has been studied a little bit recently since the dark energy became more convincing is that if there's present scalar fields in the early history of the universe, then you can't just use this equation. You have to recalculate the Hubble parameter change. You can't just assume the simple Hubble parameter from Big Bang inflation and after. You have to include the scalar fields in that calculation. And there's a few papers written on that subject which argue that the effects can be 100 or 1,000 on the energy density of the LSP just because the early history of the universe has changed compared to the simple standard Friedman-Robertson-Walker cosmology. So this is a subject that's very fascinating a number of ways because the dark matter is such an important question. And let me mention two other aspects of it then. First, how could we observe the LSP in the laboratory? There are actually four ways that we can observe LSPs in the laboratory. The first is the most commonly used and expected one, and there is about 10 experiments trying to do this now. The concept is very simple. Imagine that, if something's the lightest superpartner, it's a dark matter, then there's sort of one every region, basketball-sized region or so in the universe, in the naive models, and they're more or less at rest. So we're moving through that. We have some velocity because the sun is moving around the galaxy, and we're moving around the sun and so forth. Imagine a detector that is a totally superconducting device, and have it hit one of these LSP, have an LSP, well, the detector hits the LSP, technically, and imagine that a quark in a nucleus in the detector bounces off the LSP, exchanging a Z boson or something. It's a quark we know interaction, for example, or it can be any one of a number. Then some energy is deposited in that superconducting detector. Typically 10 to 50 keV of energy is a sort of number. And so it goes non-superconducting, and you know you've detected something. So the actual detectors, some of them actually work kind of like that. Some are different. They use phonons and such things. But there's about 10 detectors that are set up to look for recoiling energy deposited in the detector. They're called tabletop, even though some of them are a little bigger, but they're not huge. They can be done in a room. Backgrounds are a problem because cosmic rays can fake it, and radioactive decays can fake it, so you have to be clever. But the experiments are underway, and they could see LSPs in the laboratory and detect a signal. Then there's a set that are called space-based. Basically, the idea is that the LSPs annihilate in space, and in their annihilation, they create excess positrons or antiprotons or photons. They create all the standard model particles, but in particular, excesses of these that you wouldn't normally have. And you can look for those. There's an experiment called AMS planned for the space shuttle, though it's not clear it'll ever get funded to go up there. There's an amusing experiment called HEAT that was done by flying balloons just over Arizona and places, one in Canada. And using a particle physics type magnetic spectrometer detector. And they actually saw systematically an excess of positrons in about the amount and behavior that you would expect if the LSP were a Wino or Higgs-Zeno-like dominantly particle with a mass between sort of MW and 2MW. You can't be more accurate than that from limited data. So this is a real signal that's been reported and confirmed, and I actually don't know why people don't take it more seriously, but it involves some astrophysics background assumptions, and maybe that's why. But there has been a candidate signal in this kind of experiment, and there will be more experiments. If LSPs will accumulate in the center of the sun and the center of the Earth just by gravitational attraction, so their annihilation rate will go up. If LSPs have a mass of, say, 100 GeV, and they annihilate, then the annihilation products from an LSP will include some neutrinos that come from decays of taus or bs. And those neutrinos will have energies of tens of GeV, typically. And there are no tens of GeV neutrinos incident on the Earth normally. So if you have a detector that can see a 10 GeV neutrino, and the underground detector is sensitive to proton decay, can in general, then if you saw two or three events where such a neutrino came and you could, it then produces energy, so you can see that it pointed toward coming from the center of the sun or the center of the Earth, you would again have strong evidence for annihilation of something like that. Finally, all the collider events will have two LSPs, so we'll get lots of information that's relevant about that. So there will be several ways to observe the LSPs in the laboratory that are coming. These experiments are all underway in various forms. Finally, let me mention that there's a problem which is usually ignored but is serious if we really want to claim we understand what's going on. Suppose you detect an LSP by one of these methods. That doesn't in any way make a convincing argument that that LSP is actually the relic density of the universe. It says that there's something around there, and you could say, well, it has to be the whole relic density. But for example, any string theory produces axions and LSPs and possibly other stable particles. There are several examples. And those are all going to be present in the universe. So the question is not which is the LSP, the question is how much of the relic density depends on one or another. Well, if the LSP is Wino-like, it annihilates beautifully, and you can write down very nice models in which you can detect an LSP in these ways, but it actually makes up just 5 or 10% of the actual relic density of the universe. It's entirely not only allowed, but easy to construct such models. They come out whether you like it or not when you play around with such things. So we need to actually calculate the relic density. To calculate the relic density of an LSP signal is not so easy. First, you have to be able to measure the LSP mass. And that's very hard. At the collider, it's if you don't know the underlying theory and such things, measuring the mass to a factor of 2 is very tricky. There's no clean way to do that. There are ways to measure the mass from the recoils in these direct detection experiments. The recoil spectrum is very sensitive to the mass of the thing coming in. But you actually need to see the recoil energy spectrum, not just examples of a recoil that deposits some energy, but the actual quantitative spectrum in order to do that. So it's very tricky. The annihilations of LSPs can be through diagrams like a Z here. That depends, that vertex always depends on tangent beta. It can be through exchange taus, for example, giving you taus. So these are just typical diagrams. That diagram, to evaluate that and calculate the relic density, means you have to measure the tau mass. So you have to produce taus and know you did at a collider and measure their mass. And their coupling, this vertex. So if the LSP is mainly Beano, that's one kind of coupling. If it's Wino, it's another kind of coupling. You have to be able to measure not only the mass, but these couplings to calculate how often these annihilate and how many are left in the universe after the Big Bang to give you the relic density. So eventually, we'll figure out what the dark matter is if it's in this kind of context. But it will not be simple, and it'll actually take a lot of clever experiment and theory. Next time, colliders.